Listening. Task 1.
Hello everyone. Today I'm talking to science writer Andy Hicks and psychologist Dr. Karen Ferrigan about how technology affects our brains.
Hi.
Hello.
Andy, your latest book claims we shouldn't be texting, emailing, cooking and watching television all at the same time because our primitive hunter-gatherer brains are poorly suited to such high-tech multitasking.
That's one way to put it, but there's more to it. I'd argue that we think we're doing all these things simultaneously, all of us do, but in practice, the brain doesn't work that way. In terms of paying attention, what we're doing is rapidly shifting focus from one thing to the next and the next, then back around to the first. All of that comes at a cost. It depletes the resources that we need for functioning effectively. Basically, it's an illusion.
You've written about the effect of having unread emails. Can you tell us about how that affects intelligence?
Well, there was one study that showed that the distraction of knowing you've had an email that you haven't read, while it doesn't lower your overall level of intelligence permanently, it does effectively lower it at that moment, because your mind is now divided. There's a little voice inside your head asking, "Who's that from? Is it good news? Is it something that needs sorting out right now?" All these thoughts are crowding your head, taking up the place of thoughts you would rather be directing at the task at hand.
So, what can we deduce from this?
We see in studies done in various workplaces that people who are allowed to multitask get less done than people who work more methodically. But the interesting thing that comes out from the studies is that the multitaskers believe that they've been more productive. And you could say, well, why is it these people are so deluded? I'd say, just because you think something's so, doesn't make it so. One of the things we do know is that the brain is really good at tricking itself. I've seen this myself. I happen to think I tell brilliant jokes, but people around me say it isn't the case.
Karen, would you agree then that our memories aren't designed for the demands of technology, including things like remembering passwords?
Well, in terms of short-term memory, what you can hold in your consciousness is limited to three or four things. Your long-term memory, the memory you have of facts and figures, the stories that you've told about different things you've done, that's apparently unlimited. But the challenge with passwords is that they tend to be arbitrary. Different websites impose different restrictions. In some passwords, you have to have special characters, whereas others don't allow them. Some have to have at least one number, and so on. You can see the problem with trying to sort it all out. But I think we're digressing here.
So, let's move on. And would you say our brains are changing over time?
Of course, we and our brains are evolving all the time, but so slowly that we can't easily measure it. It can take a great deal of time for us to respond to developments in our circumstances. Our brains could keep pace with the world of 20,000 or more years ago. There wasn't a whole lot of information coming in back then, nor much technological change. There were hundreds of thousands of years between, say, harnessing fire and developing agriculture. Now, though, your cell phone constantly updates its software, and you've got to learn completely new things all the time. The result seems to be we all feel busier than we used to, less effective at work, and find it more difficult to make decisions.
But there are advantages that come with this information age, aren't there?
Absolutely. With the greatest respect to Karen, one of the best things, actually, is this unprecedented access to reliable information. Think back 20, 30 years. Say you wanted to know what the Krebs cycle was from biology. You'd either have to find somebody who knew or go to a library and look it up. This can now be done instantly. Almost anything you'd want to know is easily available.
The problem is that in there with all that information is so much misinformation. And it's got very difficult to know which is which. Back then, you could pick up a particular magazine and everything about it screamed, "This is an unreliable source." Now, bad websites look just as good as good websites. The most important thing we can teach is information literacy, how to tell the difference.
So, of all the interviews that we've had... Hello, everyone. Today, I'm talking to science writer Andy Hicks and psychologist Dr. Karen Ferrigan about how technology affects our brains.
Hi.
Hello.
Andy, your latest book claims we shouldn't be texting, emailing, cooking and watching television all at the same time because our primitive hunter-gatherer brains are poorly suited to such high-tech multitasking.
That's one way to put it, but there's more to it. I'd argue that we think we're doing all these things simultaneously, all of us do, but in practice, the brain doesn't work that way. In terms of paying attention, what we're doing is rapidly shifting focus from one thing to the next and the next, then back around to the first. All of that comes at a cost. It depletes the resources that we need for functioning effectively. Basically, it's an illusion.
You've written about the effect of having unread emails. Can you tell us about how that affects intelligence?
Well, there was one study that showed that the distraction of knowing you've had an email that you haven't read, while it doesn't lower your overall level of intelligence permanently, it does effectively lower it at that moment, because your mind is now divided. There's a little voice inside your head asking, "Who's that from? Is it good news? Is it something that needs sorting out right now?" All these thoughts are crowding your head, taking up the place of thoughts you would rather be directing at the task at hand.
So, what can we deduce from this?
We see in studies done in various workplaces that people who are allowed to multitask get less done than people who work more methodically. But the interesting thing that comes out from the studies is that the multitaskers believe that they've been more productive. And you could say, well, why is it these people are so deluded? I'd say, just because you think something's so, doesn't make it so. One of the things we do know is that the brain is really good at tricking itself. I've seen this myself. I happen to think I tell brilliant jokes, but people around me say it isn't the case.
Karen, would you agree then that our memories aren't designed for the demands of technology, including things like remembering passwords?
Well, in terms of short-term memory, what you can hold in your consciousness is limited to three or four things. Your long-term memory, the memory you have of facts and figures, the stories that you've told about different things you've done, that's apparently unlimited. But the challenge with passwords is that they tend to be arbitrary. Different websites impose different restrictions. In some passwords, you have to have special characters, whereas others don't allow them. Some have to have at least one number, and so on. You can see the problem with trying to sort it all out. But I think we're digressing here.
So, let's move on. And would you say our brains are changing over time?
Of course, we and our brains are evolving all the time, but so slowly that we can't easily measure it. It can take a great deal of time for us to respond to developments in our circumstances. Our brains could keep pace with the world of 20,000 or more years ago. There wasn't a whole lot of information coming in back then, nor much technological change. There were hundreds of thousands of years between, say, harnessing fire and developing agriculture. Now, though, your cell phone constantly updates its software, and you've got to learn completely new things all the time. The result seems to be we all feel busier than we used to, less effective at work, and find it more difficult to make decisions.
But there are advantages that come with this information age, aren't there?
Absolutely. With the greatest respect to Karen, one of the best things, actually, is this unprecedented access to reliable information. Think back 20, 30 years. Say you wanted to know what the Krebs cycle was from biology. You'd either have to find somebody who knew or go to a library and look it up. This can now be done instantly. Almost anything you'd want to know is easily available.
The problem is that in there with all that information is so much misinformation, and it's got very difficult to know which is which. Back then, you could pick up a particular magazine and everything about it screamed, "This is an unreliable source." Now, bad websites look just as good as good websites. The most important thing we can teach is information literacy, how to tell the difference.
So, of all the interviews that we've had...
Listening. Task 2.
You'll hear an architectural photographer called Jack Gollins talking about his work immediately after receiving a professional award. Complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at part 2.
My name, as you've probably gathered, is Jack Gollins, and I'd like to express my thanks for this wonderful award. Frankly, I'm a bit of a workaholic, busy trying to satisfy my architect clients and come up with a photograph that will put them on the map, as well as trying to satisfy my own artistic ambitions. So, to be honest, it was only when I was talking to some magazine editors recently who were consulted over my nomination that I realised what I've actually achieved so far in my field. I was genuinely taken aback by the number of projects I've done. So, how do I actually go about shooting a building? Well, I have self-imposed rules, and some of them are quirky and particular to me. I tend to use a wide-angle lens rather than a fisheye lens that some photographers prefer. I show more context than many of my colleagues too, and my compositional rules break all the normal aesthetics. I'm often asked if there are particular places in Australia or overseas that have had a big impact on me. The short answer is yes. I spent quite a few years in countries like Cambodia photographing what are called lost cities. These were generally built by the leaders of the time, and I've been very influenced by the quality of the buildings there. There are practical issues working in such places. Maybe if the building's half in ruins, I'll work at night and only light the existing half, and leave the other half to the imagination. And in India, I've had to work with strong blue filters to separate the stone from the vivid sky. But I avoid fancy gimmicks out of a respect for historic buildings. They're intrinsically remarkable buildings which don't need any special effects. I use such trips as test beds for practicing particular photographic techniques. A lot of them, like lighting buildings at night, were first tried out on my own projects, and then brought to bear on clients' modern buildings. I guess I'm well known now for my elevated shots. You can get in so close in a helicopter. And a few years back, myself and the pilot I always use, he's awesome at the controls, worked out techniques for making the most of this. We can get amazing shots by performing rapid, repeated circles and be finished before local people and tourists start complaining. I've recently shot extraordinarily beautiful nighttime pictures this way, which couldn't have been done 10 years ago. Now, potentially, an iconic building can bring in lots of money for everyone associated with it. So the pressure's on from clients for me to produce award-winning photos. But I'm a very harsh critic of my own work and will keep going back to a project until I basically think I've achieved what's known as the hero image, the definitive shot of a building which brings in the money. And it can take a lot of visits to get it right, believe me. That's one of the reasons I'm so delighted to receive this award in recognition of my work. Thank you so much.
Now you'll hear part two again. Complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at part two.
My name, as you've probably gathered, is Jack Gollins, and I'd like to express my thanks for this wonderful award. Frankly, I'm a bit of a workaholic, busy trying to satisfy my architect clients and come up with a photograph that will put them on the map, as well as trying to satisfy my own artistic ambitions. So, to be honest, it was only when I was talking to some magazine editors recently who were consulted over my nomination that I realised what I've actually achieved so far in my field. I was genuinely taken aback by the number of projects I've done. So, how do I actually go about shooting a building? Well, I have self-imposed rules, and some of them are quirky and particular to me. I tend to use a wide-angle lens rather than a fisheye lens that some photographers prefer. I show more context than many of my colleagues too, and my compositional rules break all the normal aesthetics. I'm often asked if there are particular places in Australia or overseas that have had a big impact on me. The short answer is yes. I spent quite a few years in countries like Cambodia photographing what are called lost cities. These were generally built by the leaders of the time, and I've been very influenced by the quality of the buildings there. There are practical issues working in such places. Maybe if the building's half in ruins, I'll work at night and only light the existing half, and leave the other half to the imagination. And in India, I've had to work with strong blue filters to separate the stone from the vivid sky. But I avoid fancy gimmicks out of a respect for historic buildings. They're intrinsically remarkable buildings which don't need any special effects. I use such trips as test beds for practicing particular photographic techniques. A lot of them, like lighting buildings at night, were first tried out on my own projects, and then brought to bear on clients' modern buildings. I guess I'm well known now for my elevated shots. You can get in so close in a helicopter. And a few years back, myself and the pilot I always use, he's awesome at the controls, worked out techniques for making the most of this. We can get amazing shots by performing rapid, repeated circles and be finished before local people and tourists start complaining. I've recently shot extraordinarily beautiful nighttime pictures this way, which couldn't have been done 10 years ago. Now, potentially, an iconic building can bring in lots of money for everyone associated with it. So the pressure's on from clients for me to produce award-winning photos. But I'm a very harsh critic of my own work and will keep going back to a project until I basically think I've achieved what's known as the hero image, the definitive shot of a building which brings in the money. And it can take a lot of visits to get it right, believe me. That's one of the reasons I'm so delighted to receive this award in recognition of my work. Thank you so much.